I'm Marty Moscone. Welcome to Radio Times.
We're going to cancel the Paris Climate Agreement and stop. Unbelievable. And stop all payments of the United States tax dollars to UN global warming programs.
That was candidate Donald Trump speaking at an oil and gas conference in North Dakota last May. He made good on that campaign promise yesterday with an announcement in the White House Rose Garden.
In order to fulfill my solemn duty to protect America and its citizens, the United States will withdraw from the Paris Climate Accord Thank you. Thank you. But begin negotiations to re-enter either the Paris Accord or in really entirely new transaction on terms that are fair to the United States, its businesses, its workers, its people, its taxpayers. So we're getting out, but we will start to negotiate, and we will see if we can make a deal that's fair. And if we can, that's great. And if we can't, that's fine.
While Trump's decision has its supporters, you can hear some of that applause. Many corporate leaders, governors, mayors, world leaders, and even some members of his administration and inner circle urge the president to remain with the accord. We'll talk about the environmental and business impact of this decision a bit later on in the show. Joining us now is Josh Dossie. He's White House correspondent for Politico, joins us to talk about the politics of this decision and some of the internal debates at the White House. And Josh Dossie, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thanks for having me.
There was much drama leading up to this announcement. Was the president ever really on the fence about whether to stay in or out of this accord?
I don't necessarily think so. I think he showed some openness in conversations with, his daughter, Ivanka Trump, and some business leaders and more moderate members of his administration, like Gary Cohn, the head of the National Economic Council. But I don't think there was ever a sense inside the White House that he was not going to pull out of this. Now, what it looked like, whether he entirely pulled out or tried to change the terms, whether he delayed the decision, there were various logistical questions. But, Scott Pruitt, the EPA commissioner, and Steve Bannon, the president's chief strategist, have been telling people for months, he's going to pull out, he's going to pull out. And I never saw anything covering the White House to think otherwise.
Well, he certainly created maximum drama and coverage for yesterday's announcement. Was that part of the calculation?
Yes. With Trump, everything has a bit of the reality TV show air. I mean, there was a jazz band in the Rose Garden. He declined to say what he was going to do, even though, the news had been out there for several days from, his senior administration officials. But it's kind of trademark with him. We saw with Neil Gorsuch, the Supreme Court judge, it was the air of drama, almost the Apprentice feel to it. He likes to maximize attention. And, when he ramps up the drama, he gets, wall-to-wall TV coverage on an issue. And, yesterday he had...
And here we are talking about it, right?
Right. We're all talking about it. Yesterday he had... full coverage of his entire announcement for hours. There was a lead up to it towards it, and he got to talk about his economic accomplishments in the White House. He knows how to attract ratings, attract the cameras, and he makes everything into something of a spectacle, which is something unlike we've ever seen.
Well, he did misstate a couple of things, and I'll just put one out there. This Paris Accord is a non-binding agreement. He made it sound as if that the U.S. was kind of forced into this agreement, and that there was strict criteria that we had to meet based on other countries. Can you correct that at all?
Well, I, there was a non-binding agreement. I mean, it's also that, you know, the United States will not technically pull out of this for 4 years. I mean, it was much more of a symbolic announcement yesterday to the rest of the world than it was a substantive one. I mean, there were, you know, some financial strings attached. There were, you know, some substance attached. But a lot of it was symbolism. A lot of it was, you know, the president just wanting to send a message. And if you listen to the president's rhetoric yesterday, it was all about the economy. I mean, he gave very short shrift to, you know, does he think climate change is real? Does he, you know, see, global warming as an international problem? Does he care about alliances around the world that, you know, the United States has traditionally held? I mean, only Syria and Nicaragua are, you know, not in this pact. I mean, China's in it. Germany, Britain, Italy, I mean, all of our traditional allies are in this. And, you know, he didn't talk about that much. He talked more about, you know, economic nationalism and, you know, governing to Pittsburgh instead of Paris. There was, not much attention given to the actual ramifications of the environmental decision, what it would mean to pull out. It was more, listen, this was an economic deal. This is the prism that I saw it through, and this is what we're going to do.
Well, certainly that was probably music to the ears of his supporters and probably some members of the Republican administration. Do you think he's been surprised by the pushback, especially coming from the business community, coming from his own Secretary of State who used to head up ExxonMobil? Do you think that was a surprise to the president?
It may have been startling at how vociferous it was to some degree, but I think he knew this was going to happen. And in some ways, I liken this, you know, to a travel ban. I think his administration expected widespread protest. In fact, administration officials told me and others, they kind of relished the split-screen visuals on TV of, you know, protest in the street and, you know, the president sitting in the Oval Office with CEOs or with other officials and looking like he was working. I think some of these moves that they're making are playing directly to their political base. They know they're not going to be, you know, particularly well-liked across the board. They're okay with that. I don't think when you're looking at people like Steve Bannon, people like Scott Pruitt, that the idea of international pushback or protest particularly rattle them. I think it's a way they signal to their supporters, hey, listen, we're doing what we told you we were going to do. It's hard. It's tough. And, this is what happens when you actually, you know, break the neck, so to speak.
What do you think the difference is between this and Kyoto? President George W. Bush basically said no to the 1997 Kyoto Accord. This was from the Clinton administration. Do you see some comparison, some contrast to what the U.S. is doing now?
I think the probably biggest contrast is that, you know, climate change and global warming, I think there's a lot more attention paid to it now. You know, there's been a whole compendium of research done in recent years. I think by all accounts, you know, scientists across the world believe the problem is worsening, believe there needs to be immediate action. And I think it's more into the ecosphere of political discourse, and it's more into, you know, it's more of a hot-button issue, climate change and the Paris Accord. I also think it's a political contrast, but, you know, when President Trump does anything, it immediately sends people to, their reactionary extreme positions. And I think, I don't think George W. Bush probably faced the same, anger and frustrations and kind of international repudiation that President Trump is facing today. And I'm not sure if he minds, but I think that's just reality.
But do you think that the U.S. pulling out of this will mean that coal mines will reopen, we'll get gas guzzlers back on the roads, we'll be taking down wind turbines? Is that the sort of vision as we look into the future?
Well, I think that's what the president and his team would want you to believe. I mean, you saw yesterday in his speech, he alluded several times to the coal miners and how much he loves the coal miners and how he's planning to, attend an opening of a coal mine in a couple of weeks. But economists and folks who look at the, big picture from a macro level, you know, say that there are lots of factors to why coal jobs have, you know, deteriorated over the years. It's not something that can just be returned with a swoop of a pen. It will take, you know, a lot more, it will take an entirely drastic shift in the business and political climate for that to happen. And I don't think this is going to spark, widespread, you know, recreation of coal mines across the country. I do think what President Trump and his team, you know, often say is, you know, look at the confidence of American businesses. They love looking at the consumer confidence index. They say people are investing again. They feel better about the economy. And some of those numbers have gone up. They are correct. But, you know, whether those are actually going to lead to you know, widespread gains they can tout, or whether they're just, you know, tentative, you know, signals, it's too early to know.
Well, there's an interesting quote from Gary Cohn. He's Trump's top economic advisor, saying last week, quoting here, coal doesn't even make that much sense anymore as a feedstock. Which is an interesting comment coming from the president's top economic advisor. Let me ask you, though, Josh, about the fact that the Trump administration has really gone after the EPA, gone after the Clean Power Plan. Do you think that's going to have more of an impact on the U.S. and its policies related to the environment than even the Paris Accord?
It's interesting. I want to talk about the Gary Cohn comment for a second. We reported, and others did too, that him saying that actually made the president double down in deciding what he was going to do, and the president was not pleased with that comment from his chief economic advisor, needless to say. But you know, it's hard to say. I mean, Scott Pruitt has made clear that he sees one of his key jobs at EPA as, you know, upending the regulatory state, deregulating a lot of our, you know, rules that were put in place by Obama and other Democrats in the White House. And I think when you talk to conservatives who are, you know, not necessarily pleased at the speed that the president's congressional agenda is going, you know, that health care is not moving fast, that taxes, you know, may not get done this year like they wanted, one of the things they repeatedly say is how pleased they are with Scott Pruitt, how pleased they are with kind of the unwinding of the regulatory state. I mean, in some ways, that's a way that this administration is actually doing a lot that's kind of behind the scenes that probably doesn't get the attention, you know, that some of the more high-profile battles get. You know, among groups like the Heritage Foundation, Americans for Prosperity, the Koch Back Network, you know, some of the more right-wing conservative groups, they love Scott Pruitt. And, you know, a lot of these businesses also love Scott Pruitt. You know, when he was Oklahoma Attorney General, he worked very closely, some would say too closely, you know, with lobbyists for the coal industry and for, you know, the organizations that he was supposed to regulate. And I think that's happening here as well. So, you know, I think the EPA has been very, you know, pro-business, very conservative, very free market. And it's really pleased people on the right. Now, what the ramifications are of that on the environment and, you know, the public policy making, you know, that's up for others to decide.
Well, Josh Dossie, thanks for joining us today in Radio Times, White House correspondent for Politico.
Thank you.
You're very welcome. We're going to take a very short break, and then we will be talking about some of the environmental and business impacts of the decision the president made yesterday to pull out of the Paris Accord. And you can join our conversation, 1-888-477-9499. You can also send us a comment, 267-405-2006. You can email us, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY. Radio Times. Many ways to join the conversation. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoen. You know by now that President Trump announced yesterday he was pulling out of the Paris Climate Agreement. And we were just talking about some of the politics behind this decision. Now we want to look at the impact that this withdrawal will have on global efforts to combat climate change, also how business and industry are reacting to the news. Joining us by telephone is Michael Oppenheimer. He's the Albert G. Milbank Professor of Geosciences and International Affairs at Princeton University. He's a longtime participant in the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, IPCC, also co-editor of Climatic Change and the editor-in-chief of Climatic Change Letters. Michael Oppenheimer, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Good to be here.
Also with us is Eric Ortz, and he's the Guardsmark Professor at the Wharton School at the University of Pennsylvania, where he's director of the Initiative for Global Environmental Leadership. Eric Ortz, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Nice to be here, too.
Michael, let me begin with you. I'm just broadly speaking, what's your reaction to the president's decision yesterday?
Well,
the short version, if that's possible, but no, go ahead.
at the broadest possible level. First of all, the speech was a fantasy. He was going hammer and tongs at the Paris Agreement, but really it was a 20-year-old speech criticizing the Kyoto Protocol. There wasn't one word of truth in his speech about the Paris Agreement. It actually had no bearing on Paris because the Paris Agreement does not require the U.S. to do anything except develop and submit plans for how the U.S. would reduce its emissions. So just from the beginning, it was a fantasy, a political act, a symbolic act, and from that point of view, shouldn't be taken seriously. On the other hand, it could have a devastating effect on the ability of the U.S. and the world not only to meet the goals of the plans that were laid down at Paris, the so-called nationally determined contributions, but ultimately to meet the long-term goal of the UN Framework Convention on Climate Change, which is to avoid a dangerous warming. And I think that if we don't meet the goal of avoiding a 2 degrees Celsius above pre-industrial level target as laid out by the countries in 2009, then a large share of the responsibility will be laid at Trump's feet.
Just a quick follow-up before we get Eric in on the conversation. Are you concerned, Michael, that other countries, big emitting countries like the United States, will pull out of this accord or sort of go their own way or not live up to some of their agreements?
Two things will happen. Number one, the U.S. Regulations that are in law, although some of them are stayed by court decisions temporarily, the implementation of those parts of the regulations that are actually not stayed by the courts will probably be slowed because the Trump administration isn't going to go out of its way to make sure that we actually meet up to those legal obligations. That's one thing that the announcement meant. And the other thing is that other countries will then look at us and say, well, we're out of Paris. We're slowing our own efforts to reduce our greenhouse gas emissions. Why should we continue with our efforts? And in particular, that will adhere to countries that are just emerging in terms of not only their economies and contributions to greenhouse gas emissions, but their interest in doing something to limit those emissions. So I'm talking there about countries like India, Vietnam, Brazil, eventually Malaysia, and other countries in Southeast Asia and eventually Latin America and Africa. Those countries are probably going to hesitate, slow down, in their efforts to constrain their emissions. And the reality is the clock is ticking. We're out of time. It was going to be hard enough to avoid dangerous climate change anyway. This slowdown makes it virtually impossible, in my view, to avoid the 2-degree warming that countries committed to not transcending.
Eric, let me turn to you and Michael describe what he saw as the environmental impact. What do you see as the sort of business economic impact of what the president said yesterday?
Well, I think the hope that the president has and some of his advisors is that this will have a economically beneficial effect, so that the statements are that jobs will be increased and that and the overall economy will be increased. I agree with the previous the commentator on the previous segment that business has been happy, many businesses at least, with a decreased emphasis on regulation, and so that you can explain some of the bump up in the stock market from the anticipation that there will be less regulation, and that is including in environmental regulation. The problem, though, is how long is that? What is that measuring? In other words, how far in the future are you measuring that? Do you only want to make decisions based on what the current stock market prices are going to be, or do you really want to take seriously the long-term effects of what most observers think are positive environmental regulations with respect to air, water, et cetera, in the basic way, but then also looking forward as a very serious threat, which many businesses see and which explains why many, many leading businesses were lobbying Trump very hard to not take this step.
And these were big-name businesses, oil companies,
for instance. There's going to be a hit on them, and they were not taking that position for nothing. It wasn't just out of the goodness of their hearts. There was a well-publicized letter in the Wall Street Journal. It was partially organized, I think, by Ivanka Trump, in fact, and trying to convince companies to come together. But they had a letter, but it went through some basic problems of what happens now is that the competitiveness of U.S. companies is now going to be restricted globally. That's going to hurt. And so that's why you had a lot of the big companies and, you know, you just go down the list. But these are not minor companies and
gotcha.
They're not liberal companies. It's 3M, Dow Chemical, Pacific Gas and Electric, Bank of America, DuPont, GE, Goldman Sachs, Coca-Cola, Unilever, Morgan Stanley, Walt Disney, et cetera. What is somewhat startling about – it's not unexpected because we knew that Trump was elected on this promise and he's now delivering on that promise. What's disappointing is that he appears not to listen to almost a unified front of businesses, excepting maybe a few of the fossil fuel companies. But even there, you had Shell, Chevron, BP, Exxon itself – all also saying stay in the Paris Agreement, and yet the president is not able to apparently be reasonable enough to listen to what those effects are. And so you're asking, but it's there's a number of problems.
This is a little wonky, but he did quote the National Economic Research Associates basically saying that if we stayed in Paris, we would be losing, 6.5 million industrial jobs, 3 trillion in lost economic output by the year 2040. Is there a way to succinctly say true, not true?
Well, you can say it's not easy to say true, not true, but you can say that's distinctly flawed. And so it was sponsored by one of their sponsors was the U.S. Chamber of Commerce. So the source of this study is suspect because they have been taking an anti-climate change position mm-hmm. for some time. And I think if you look at the study, the clearest indication of a problem is in one footnote where they say, we are only going to look at the cost to businesses of this, of what happens. We're not going to look at potential benefits of what you get if you curtail emissions. So that's just crazy. That's like saying we will have an air pollution control in a city or something, and we're going to only count the cost that it will have on the businesses to control. But we're not going to count any of the benefits that we have of less lung cancer, less emphysema cases, or less asthma, right? It just it doesn't make any sense from an economic point of view. So once again, I mean, my attitude toward speeches that the president gives, unfortunately, now is that I don't even watch them live because it makes sense to wait until the fact checkers have a chance to tell you to look at this. And this is certainly true in this case. Now, one other thing to say there is, it's very difficult to predict job growth, et cetera. But one thing that we do see is that jobs in the solar industry, for example, are outpacing job creation in many other industries. And so right now, the U.S. Department of Labor indicates there are more jobs in solar, twice as many jobs in solar than there is in coal.
Yeah, interesting.
And that solar industry and from 2010 to 2016, for example, has been growing at 20% a year. Now, some of that's driven by subsidies, et cetera, but a lot of that is just driven by lower cost of solar, and
I'm trying to shoehorn a lot of stuff in here, and I've got two guests with lots of information. That's Eric Ortz, who joins us along with Michael Oppenheimer. We are talking about the president's announcement yesterday, pulling the United States out of the Paris Climate Agreement. And you can join the conversation by calling us at 1-888-477-9499. Michael, I'm sure you have a lot to say, but let me ask you something, because the president called out China several times yesterday, basically saying China taking advantage of this climate agreement and, sort of making the U.S. a kind of a laughingstock of the rest of the world. When you look at China, and we're number two, they're number one when it comes to carbon emissions. How have they been doing?
Well, actually, it was kind of what the president presented was a picture that's a flip of reality. The climate agreement, the Paris Agreement, was designed along U.S. specifications. It was designed to not be binding because the U.S. didn't think it could get a binding agreement through the U.S. Senate, quite rightly, where it would have to be ratified.
Right.
It was designed to bring China and other big developing countries that have a lot of emissions to the table, unlike the Kyoto Protocol. So, without Paris, actually, the U.S. is relatively disadvantaged in a number of ways, including, as Eric said, the less likelihood that we'll develop a robust domestic market for renewable energy. We'll do it anyway, but at a lower level, and that puts our businesses in a less competitive posture. But in addition, China's actually been moving ahead very fast. Their nationally determined contribution, their emissions plan submitted to Paris, has them peaking in emissions at 2030. Well, Chinese emissions actually may have peaked already. It's not clear. Some of the progress in China is due to a slowdown in their economy, but a lot of it is due to an attempt to reconfigure their energy system, in particular to reduce air pollution in addition to greenhouse gases. So they're trying hard, and when I say they, I mean the central government, to reduce the dependence on coal. So far, China actually is in some sense making more progress than the U.S. has. Not only their CO2 emissions look like they may have peaked, but their coal use may have peaked. So there is no argument here that this was a great boon to China. The only boon to China is that if eventually the world moves expeditiously to cut greenhouse gas emissions, that since China wisely made a big investment in solar photovoltaic production and wind turbine production and is a world's leader in both, it's entirely likely that China will have some economic gain out of that. But then again, why can't the U.S. firms grab some of that back? And the answer is they're less likely to do it now that the government has sent this signal.
Let me play something that California Governor Jerry Brown said yesterday. He was speaking to the Los Angeles Times about the president backing out of the Paris Agreement.
It cannot stand. It's not right. And California will do everything it can to not only stay the course, but to build more support in other states, other provinces, and with other countries.
And it is interesting, both to you, Michael, but to you, Eric, as well, which is you've got governors, you've got mayors, the mayor of Philadelphia, the governor of Pennsylvania, other governors, you've got business people, as you were talking about, Eric, and you've got California, you know, which is one of the largest economies in the world, basically saying, we're sticking with Paris. What does that mean, Eric?
Well, this raises a very interesting point. Well, I'm sorry. Let me make a point that I was trying to complete before.
Sure, no problem.
Just to follow on what Eric said before, one of the ways business loses because of Trump's announcement is that they will now face, instead of federal greenhouse gas regulation, differentiated regulation running from nothing to very strong regulation as California is imposing, which will differ from state to state. And one thing that business hates is having to deal with a crazy quilt of state-level regulation. So that's one reason you've got a lot of companies coming out and saying, we want the federal presence here.
Well, Eric, go ahead.
Well, yeah. And one way to think about this, and I think Governor Brown also mentioned this, is that there's a paradoxical way in which this could be positive for regulation, for solving the problem. And that is that it may galvanize the forces in the world, and former President Obama said this as well, that it's possible that states, cities, businesses, universities, and there's an effort being currently organized, I believe, by Michael Bloomberg around this effort, this idea, to basically say, well, we don't have to follow the White House. This is still a free country in the sense that businesses, consumers, states can decide to go their own way on this. California might be leading, but New York and Washington are not far behind. They're also involved in this, and other states may also decide to join the charge on that. Businesses are signing up. I believe something on the order of 80 university presidents have signed up to say, yeah, we will support the possibility of complying with the Paris Agreement even without the White House. So that makes it not easy. And Michael is right to say that business is one reason business prefer to have leadership from the federal government. You don't want to have this kind of messy situation. But if you're forced to be in this kind of a situation, then I think the possible silver lining is that this will galvanize those who really see this as a critical problem that we all have to play a hand in solving. States will go their own way. Businesses will become more proactive and not just wait to be regulated, but actually get out in front of the issue. And consumers and citizens will too. So that is one possible optimistic way
sure.
to read this.
Yeah. And Michael, going back to you, it is interesting when you see, I mean, turn on your television and you see companies, whether it's true or not, you know, advertising their greenness, their environmental stewardship. And one wonders whether it's technology or education or good business sense, whether that's where the energy and interest is in dealing with challenges to global warming. Do you see it that way?
There are a lot of factors in play. Number one, the whole argument that some elements of the business community used to hide behind, namely scientific uncertainty, you didn't hear a peep about that yesterday. Right. It seems that argument is now evaporated, and what Trump wants to emphasize is the economic issues and what a sensible policy would be versus what the Obama administration was doing. And as far as I'm concerned, that's where the debate should be. There's been, for too long, there's been a miasma created by certain elements in the business community funding contrarian voices, which have essentially been distorting and lying about the science. There are other issues at play. One is companies like to certainly posture and look green.
Right.
But beyond all of that, there is a very serious understanding in large sectors of the business community that the future is not in coal, it's not in pollution, it's in cleaner industries, it's in efficiency, it's in renovating the U.S. electricity grid. It's getting a lot of things done that make the ability of business to function in the future world much more efficient, much more effective, and give us a way to participate in the global markets for these technologies, which we haven't had recently. And instead, what Trump has given them is basically a very raw deal, because one of the things that could happen now, I'm not predicting this, but it's been talked about, and the Europeans, I think, are going to start thinking about it again.
You know what, Michael, hold on to that thought only because we're up on a break, and I don't want to have us hanging right before the break. Talking with Michael Oppenheimer from Princeton University, longtime participant in the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. Also with us, Eric Ortz, and he's a professor at the Wharton School, University of Pennsylvania, talking about the president's decision yesterday. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoen, and we are talking about the impact, as seen by our guests, of the withdrawal from the Paris Climate Agreement, President Trump's announcement yesterday. And again, our guests are Michael Ortz, and he's director of the Initiative for Global Environmental Leadership at the University of Pennsylvania's Wharton School, where he's also a professor. And again, Michael Oppenheimer, the professor of Geosciences and International Affairs at Princeton University, longtime participant in the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. And you can join our conversation. Call us at 1-888-477-9499. I'll read some comments just a bit later on in the show. Michael, there was something you wanted to say.
Yeah, I'm saying one other thing that's in the air is that some of the European countries in particular may decide to levy a border tax adjustment, or essentially a fee, on U.S. energy-intensive goods entering the Union as a compensation for the fact that the EU has stringent greenhouse gas controls and the U.S. doesn't, and that does involve a relative decrease in the competitiveness, presumably, of some of their goods versus ours. This has been talked about for years. It may or may not be legal under WTO protocols. But the EU came very close to doing something similar in the aviation sector a couple of years ago, and that triggered, by the way, an international agreement on restricting greenhouse gases on aviation. So I wouldn't be entirely surprised if they did that again. And again, the business community in the U.S. is not going to like that.
Oh, Eric, go ahead.
Yeah, well, I agree with that. That's a risk, and it's another reason why many businesses were against leaving the Paris Agreement. One other just comment to make about the bigger picture about jobs and economy. And I think one thing that's missed is that if you really think about how many jobs would be created by making the transition to clean energy economy, it's a massive number. So what you have to do is you basically are changing the the grid. You're moving to an electricity-based renewable energy supply economy, and that involves jobs to change the grid, new innovations for how you're producing the energy, how you're storing energy, et cetera. So this really is a hit long-term on economic growth and job creation from that point of view. And I think that that was also an issue that a number of the big businesses were emphasizing.
Well, I know, and I'm sure that if I were a coal miner, I would probably feel happier today. I don't know whether to you, Eric.
There's not many of them. There's not very many of them.
There are about 70,000, I think, across the country.
And they're declining. And I think in your first sector has indicated, the reason they're declining is that coal is no longer viable economically.
Because
so natural gas is wiping it out, but it's also dirty, and it'll be like a horse and buggy in a few decades. And as also indicated, China's phasing them out, India's phasing them out. The technology is moving forward beyond that. It's not really a policy question. It's just a technology and business question at this point.
Let me play another clip from yesterday. This is President Trump in the Rose Garden announcing the U.S. is withdrawing from the Paris Climate Agreement.
It is time to put Youngstown, Ohio, Detroit, Michigan, and Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, along with many, many other locations within our great country, before Paris, France. It is time to make America great again. Thank you.
Well, the mayor of Pittsburgh tweeted yesterday, "I can assure you that we will follow the guidelines of the Paris Agreement for our people, our economy, and our future." Michael, you know, setting up this little battle over not just the Paris Accord, but, you know, what local communities are doing to deal with the problem of climate change. And I guess in many ways, you know, if you're the mayor of Miami, I don't know if he signed on to this or not, but you're seeing the sea level rise.
Right. I work on the New York Panel of Climate Change, which is a mayor's appointed technical panel trying to advise New York City on dealing with sea level rise and extreme heat. And I'll tell you, the threat is extremely daunting, and a lot of mayors and governors are getting on the problem now, trying to make sensible plans for defending their cities against this risk. And at the same time, the federal government basically is pulling out. The Obama administration had begun to seriously fund and create a structure for dealing with helping localities defend themselves against climate change. And Trump announced a couple of months ago that they were ending federal support for climate adaptation just when it's most needed. Mm-hmm. So the cities, I think, feel like they've been set afloat in a rising sea, so to speak. And they are going to have gotten together. They're going to be sharing information. Many of them are moving forward to cut their own emissions, although in total, it's not clear how much difference that'll make. But the political, what this does is it organizes basically a political constituency around pressing forward, opposing the lack of a federal policy, and trying to get things done despite the resistance of the federal government. So this goes along again with the efforts at the state level to try to reduce emissions and hopefully provides some assistance for local adaptation. This is part of the infrastructure of dealing with climate change that will go forward regardless of what the federal government does or does not do. Unfortunately, the federal government is where most of the money comes from for this sort of activity, and it's all going to sort of be hobbled unless the Trump policy is reversed. Mm.
Let me get Andrew from Pineville to join our conversation. Andrew, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Well good morning.
Good morning.
And I wanted to say that what I heard the president's speech yesterday, what I heard him say was he thought that this was a bad deal for the United States,
right,
and that we have $20 trillion in debt, and that we really should pay more attention to spending our money here. Now, I don't know whether I agree or disagree with his decision, but I do know that Americans will step up to the plate, and I know that we'll take care of things the way we've been taking care of them for 50 years. But I would like to know more about the deal. And with all due respect, I would rather hear I'd also like to hear a business person. And our country's been run by an Ivy League professor for 8 years, and I really would like to get a different point of view.
Well, we have a business professor sitting across from me.
I don't know. I might be a combination that's not adequate because I teach in a business school, but it's an Ivy League business school.
But
I would say it's a good question. One aspect of the Paris Agreement, though, is that there isn't actually a deal in the sense that there is a required U.S. response. So one thing that was mentioned is that it's true that the Obama administration committed to a $3 billion payment into a fund along with all the other countries in the world. So that was a commitment, a promise that one made. And I think it is, at least my position would be, that that was money that should be spent. It is basically targeting those poor countries that are also the most vulnerable. So think of island countries that are literally going to be wiped out from climate change, or how do you adapt if you're Bangladesh and you have low sea level, et cetera. And you might say, well, we don't want to spend money on those people, and then there's a policy debate about that. But the point is that the Paris Agreement actually doesn't require you to do that. So the President Trump could have said, you know, I disagree with Obama. He spent $1 billion of the $3 billion, but I'm now not going to spend the next $2 billion. And there was no there's no problem. In other words, well,
he's
people would be upset.
That, right?
People would be upset, but no one can sue him, right? There's no enforcement mechanism. And to that extent, that's why this is a little bit crazy in that sense. There's no requirement under Paris to do anything except say what you're doing. And then it's perfectly legitimate under the agreement that a president can change, or the Congress can change, what the target will be. If Obama had a very ambitious target compared to what the new administration wanted, you can just change the target. You don't have to leave the whole deal. And I think that's what's so surprising and disturbing, is that the U.S. is stepping away from leadership in the world on this. And you're stepping into the camp of Syria, Nicaragua, and the United States as being out of the agreement entirely. And there's a number of ways in that which that's problematic. One of the main ones is that the U.S. was a very strong voice for the need for monitoring and verifying what the actual emissions were around the world. And there are problems with that. And one problem is in China. Another one is, well, there are other countries. So now that we're completely out of it, that voice is going to be less strong, and the progress under the agreement will be less quick, and that's a problem.
Yeah.
That's disturbing.
Michael, let me go back to you. Let's say the U.S. stayed in the Paris Agreement. Let's say it hit the mark that it had. I hope I get this right, and you can correct me if I don't. No more than 2% Celsius increase over in pre-industrial.
It's 2 degrees.
2 degrees.
It's 2 degrees, which is 3.6 degrees Fahrenheit above pre-industrial temperatures.
Okay. Let's say we hit that. Would that mitigate the problems of climate change that seem already kind of baked into the system?
Well, there's damage already. There's going to be more, and we're already a degree Celsius, or 1.8 degrees Fahrenheit or so, a little less than that, above pre-industrial temperatures. And things are starting to happen. Sea level has risen. Species are moving. Certain ecosystems like the Great Barrier Reef in Australia are in trouble. Crop yields are beginning the growth in the rate of increase in crop yields, which is needed because populations are increasing, has started to stabilize and in some areas declined. And there's been more and more episodes of extreme heat, including the 2003 heat wave in Europe that killed an estimated 40,000 people. So we're not going to avoid damages no matter what. The question is, when does it spin out of control? The best measure we have is to ask the question, the last time Earth was as warm as 2 degrees Celsius above pre-industrial levels, what happened? One of the things we know happened, and this was about 125,000 years ago, is that sea level rose somewhere between 20 and 30 feet above what it is now. And that would be devastating. It's not going to happen overnight, but it could happen gradually over the course of 100 or 200 years. And sea level is already rising. The risk is that if we do nothing now, we go above the 2-degree limit, that it accelerates, and by the end of this century, we have a sea level rise, which instead of about 6-7 inches, which is what happened over the last century, we have about 6-7 feet, which would be, for the U.S. East Coast, intolerable.
67 feet. Risk. I mean, would New York even survive something like that?
Survive, yes, but large parts of New York would either be underwater or have to be defended by building a permanent seawall or a surge barrier, the way the Thames, for instance, has a surge barrier. But it would have to be done very quickly. It would be incredibly expensive. And so when you talk about the costs of action against climate change, you have to weigh it against these very large risks. And it just doesn't make sense to me to take the risk. So that's bad thinking is what led governments to declare the climate danger zone, so to speak, as the terrain above a warming of 2 degrees Celsius or 3.6 degrees Fahrenheit.
Let me read. Yeah, go ahead, Eric.
Well, one other thing is that that's actually just that's somewhat. There are many scientists, and I think, Michael, you would confirm this, that there's a risk that you go even higher than that. And so that there's a bandwidth here of real need, that this is extreme. And if people understand the science, then there's really no doubt that it's like the risk of your house burning down, and do you take insurance policies out? And but there, you know, mass migrations, mass starvations, there's possibilities that you go not stay at 2 degrees, but go to 3 degrees or even 4 degrees centigrade, and that really is catastrophic. And that's why scientists are very concerned, and I think that that's why everyone is now, I think most people, a vast majority of the United States population now understands the risks and wants to do something about it. And that's what's so disappointing about this decision by the president.
Let me just read a bunch of comments. A tweet from Quinn: I'm 65 years old, and I'm apologizing to future generations for what we've let happen. An email from Phyllis: in reality, this move is symbolic. Its real effect will be economic harm to the U.S. What's next? Ban cars to bring back buggy whips? A tweet from Oscar: can someone comment on Mayor Bloomberg's announcement? We did actually take care of that. Can your guests explain where the claims came from about the millions and billions of dollars the U.S. will pay to other countries? We did touch on that as well. Let me ask, you, Michael, and I'm old enough to remember in the 70s, before the EPA and before Nixon actually got involved in the environmental movement, about the kind of smog. We had, one of the Great Lakes that caught fire. I mean, we have sea level rise, but we have, beautiful blue skies. If we had more Beijings and less, Philadelphias, would we be in a different situation in terms of dealing with this problem of climate change?
Well, yeah, you've hit the nail on the head that this problem, despite the changes that are occurring, remains rather abstract for most people. It used to be in your face. I'm old enough to remember when the air was dirty in where I lived, which is New York City, and you could taste it, you could feel it. I lived in Chicago for a while. It would lodge in the back of your throat, and you'd have a sour taste due to the coal burning from every apartment building. That got people active. Climate change is a much more abstract problem. It's something where the worst effects are long in the future in some way, or at least further in the future. And it's a problem that is hard to understand for the average person who doesn't want to grapple with the details of the science. That has gotten in the way of political mobilization. But the reality is, when you have problems like that, people can get together, they can act, and the difference is political leadership. Mm. We did have a strong approach to the problem under President Obama. He understood the problem. He took the time to study it. He provided the political leadership. And now that's turned around 180 degrees because we have a leader who apparently doesn't want to lead on this problem.
Well,
and in fact, wants to go out and do damage.
We have to end on that note. I wish we could go on. Michael Oppenheimer, thanks so much for joining us today on Radio Times.
A pleasure.
And Eric Ortz, thank you for coming in as well.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes to find out much more about this program. Diana Martinez, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Builder, John Ahrens, and Trinae Nuri. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Thank you so much for joining us.